And that's the Kiki music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. It's almost May, and for us, that means it's time to look ahead to summer movies. We'll talk about what we're looking forward to and perhaps dreading, and talk about some of the biggest films expected between now and the time when the leaves fall. And as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and pop culture and theater and things like that.
Now, you might have noticed we went around the table in a different order, and that's because we are sitting here in our new digs.
I know.
And I picked the wrong seat.
Yeah, it's a different setup. We all have new chairs now. It's going to be very confusing, and I will have to get used to it, and it will be an adjustment for all of us, but we're going to do our very best.
We are still the same people talking into microphones.
It's true.
Different pop screens, though.
It's true. We have new pop screens.
And the really funny thing is that the three boys are all on one side of the table, and Linda is like in the command chair.
Yep. That's right.
I feel like a mathlete. It's so strange.
Like we're in Quiz Bowl.
More so than usual.
Yeah. I'm in charge more than ever.
We need buzzers.
Yeah, you do need buzzers. It's going to be like Jeopardy. I'm going to just go from person to person. And we now have a setup where our charming producer, Jess Gittner, can just talk in my ear and just tell me when one of you is being boring.
So there we go, or
more importantly, when I'm being boring. Or she could tell all of you when I'm being boring, and you could all just wave your arms, and you know, it would be very helpful to me.
That's what we need.
So summer movies. It is currently, as we tape this, we're about to go into the last week of April, and then after that it will be May, and as we all know, the summer movie season starts well before Memorial Day these days.
Long, long before.
It is the first weekend in May is now I feel like the official start of summer movie season, right?
Yeah. Sort of, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it gets there, yeah.
It's the Iron Man rule.
Yeah.
It's whenever an Iron Man movie comes out, it's time for the summer movie season.
Well, so are you telling me, Stephen, that you are looking forward to Iron Man 3?
Okay, see, here's my problem.
One of them.
One of several. I went through, you know, and kind of excitedly caught myself up on what was coming out in the summer movie season, and I could not believe how incredibly grim so many of the choices looked.
Yeah.
I mean, all the superhero movies are like a hero's fall.
Sure. Yeah.
All the big budget CGI movies are like the world has ended.
Yep.
A lot of apocalypse.
I was really gloomed out.
You're really bummed, yeah.
Iron Man 3, when I see an Iron Man movie, when I saw The Avengers, I think of that as a fun character. And when I think of summer movie season, I think of escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really taken aback by how few movies there were on the docket where I would look at them, look at the plot description, and think, that looks like fun.
That looks fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked before about the balance of light and dark with Iron Man and superheroes in general.
Sure, and I think there's a lot of that. I think Glenn is probably going to want to talk about Man of Steel, which is certainly about the rise of a mythic hero.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some dark to it, I imagine. But still, I think if you're worried about your Hangover sequels and your Men of Steel and your Cumberbatchified Star Treks, which is certainly going to be dark.
Mm-hmm. It's called Star Trek Into Darkness.
Into Darkness, right.
You're gonna
want to watch out for things like your Despicable Me 2s, which is going to be cute, and also for a movie called Epic, which is coming out at the end of May from the people behind Ice Age and Rio. It is about teeny tiny leaf people who live in the forest and protect the natural
Glenn's
world.
Like, I'm so out.
And their fall from grace.
No, they protect the natural.
And then the lawnmower.
Sure.
They protect the natural world from us and from Christoph Waltz, who is apparently the big bad in this movie. So
a Nazi.
Right away, you're in, right?
He's probably not a Nazi.
And then the trailer keeps going, and you realize that Beyoncé is also in this movie, voicing a character who is apparently like the queen of the forest people or something like that. And you're like, my appetite for camp and I are totally in, because there is no way I'm not seeing this on opening weekend in 3D with 12 other gay men.
All right, well...
I had no idea that Epic was okay.
Stephen's like, we learn something new every week.
Yeah,
about
you wouldn't understand, Stephen. It's coded.
It has coded Beyonce in a big dress made out of what appears to be flower petals.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying.
You know, there's a film coming out called Pacific Rim, which has the trappings of grimness, but it's about a giant robot fighting a giant monster. So this is going to bring back all your Ultraman, your Johnny Sacco and his flying robots, your space giants.
around the globe as leaders of other organizations are desperate. Nobody can tell us where they came from or what they are.
We always thought alien life would come from the stars. But it came from deep beneath the sea, a portal between dimensions in the Pacific Ocean.
I don't remember who stars in it. I know it is Guillermo del Toro, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm. And Idris Elba.
Right.
Paging Tanya Ballard Brown.
Of course, mm-hmm. So I'm in for that. I am worried about the spate of superhero films. There's five of them, if you count The Lone Ranger, which I think sneaks in under the grandfather clause.
Yeah.
You got Iron Man 3, you got Man of Steel, which I'll talk about in a bit. You got Kick-Ass 2, and you got Wolverine.
It's actually The Wolverine.
Sure it is.
Ugh.
I've talked about Iron Man 3 before. Here's the thing with Man of Steel.
If only we had an expert on Superman.
In the field of Superman.
Oh,
somebody
God.
Who's written a book or...
Well, someday. We'll have to just wait. Man of Steel, okay, Christopher Nolan is producing this. This is, generally speaking, a good thing because you know it's going to be well thought out. It's going to be grounded in the real. You also know, however, that Christopher Nolan, one of the things he has, if he was directing this film, he has sort of a tonal monochromatic scale. He has one cool, chilly vibe that he infuses his films in, and so there's not a lot of gradation. Now, his films
are... You're saying the suit is charcoal and gray, right?
Well, it's a muted blue. But here's the thing. I mean, it's kind of my emotional body temperature. It feels very comfortable to me, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
But it's something to be concerned about. The problem here is that Zack Snyder is, what is the word? A hack.
You're talking about the director.
I'm talking about the director, Zack Snyder, who makes films that look pretty but have sort of a video game depth to them.
He did 300.
He did 300. He did Sucker Punch. Now, if you make a film like Sucker Punch, they should take your megaphone, your jodhpurs, and your beret away from you and say, you can't direct films anymore.
Yeah.
All directors in my head look like...
I was going to say they have jodhpurs.
Look like Rita Moreno and Electric Company.
You have just made a reference that is lost on at least half of our audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there is in this film a thing that all superhero films need that the superhero films that fail do not have, which is shirtlessness.
Ooh,
we need shirtlessness.
Yeah.
And we get some.
Yeah.
Paging Thor.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I know that was your big, that was one of your big things with Captain America, and that worked out okay.
Oh, yeah. It worked out great.
Yes, it did.
That's a good movie and full of shirtlessness.
Exactly.
I see your point. How about you, Thompson? What are you excited about?
Well, Glenn.
Shirtlessness.
Yes. Glenn already mentioned Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. I wrote down Monsters versus Robots and just left it at that.
What's going to be wrong with that?
I was going to filibuster on Monsters versus Robots for a while. I mean, I worry in general with movies in which monsters battle robots that you're basically just going to see what might as well be an animated movie as far as the level of CGI-ification. But Pacific Rim seemed like it has a little bit of a lighter touch. And I'm going to come back to this point again and again on how few of these big movies appear to have an impish quality to them. I feel like some movies should have a little bit of impishness. But here's one, The Heat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. When you look at the plot description for The Heat, it is buddy cop movie patterned after Running Scared.
All right. I think we have a little sound from this one.
Okay.
Sir, I don't understand. I've closed more cases than any agent here. FBI.
She's a tight-ass federal agent.
You're skilled.
You're not a team player. None of the other agents like you. Wait for my recount.
What? Unbelievable.
She's a badass Boston cop.
Hey, look who's here! Right into my mousetrap!
Run, she's crazy!
From Paul Feig, the director of Bridesmaids.
I think this individual might be mentally ill.
No, 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 just work with her. She is the best cop.
Motherfucker!
Linda did a giant double take. Now, it's important for you all to notice that this is a Sandra Bullock movie. So that's the first voice you heard. Everybody was very anxious that this was going to turn out to be Miss Congeniality 3.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy.
Right.
Directed by Paul Feig. Mm-hmm. Written by Katie Dippold of Parks and Recreation.
Right.
And as you can kind of tell from the tone of the trailer, I mean, they're not being straight-faced about she's a badass Boston cop, you know?
She is, in fact, a giant slob with anger management issues.
Sure. So, first of all, obviously, you have the buddy cop movie in which the buddy and the cop are women.
Uh-huh.
But also you have Paul Feig, who has a pretty remarkable track record.
Bridesmaids, and also did worked on The Office, but also did Freaks and Geeks. Is really the Freaks and Geeks guy, at least as much as Apatow.
Yeah, and so to me, like, looking all over the map for fun, this was one that really jumped out at me.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, it's impossible to know, but I personally, I like Sandra Bullock in comedies. I prefer her in comedies to her in sort of these big kind
weepy
of
dramas.
Weepy thing that she, the other thing she does. I like her in comedies. I've always thought she was funny. From what I've seen in the trailer, this is Melissa McCarthy, goofy, but not as much a grotesque as she's been in some, as they've sort of presented her to be in other things, which I'm a little less interested in. So I'm optimistic about this one, too. It's one of those where you really can't tell. I think the trailer's funny, but it's hard to tell.
Yeah, the trailer actually sort of left me in stitches, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this movie.
Yeah.
But it's you're right. It's one of those that you're not going to know until you're halfway through it, and you can see, or at least a third of the way through it, and you can get a feel for how the beats are going.
There's just no portent. That's so incredibly important this summer.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And, you know, among other things, these are two incredibly gifted physical comedians.
Yeah,
so if
they're both
funny. If for that only, I think I'm
I would watch Miss Congeniality 3.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the portents things. There are three films coming out this summer which your mom is going to get confused. And those are Oblivion.
60 years ago, Earth was attacked. We won the war. But they destroyed half the planet.
After Earth.
Crash landed. Two confirmed survivors. Everything on this planet has evolved to kill humans.
And Elysium.
I need to get to Elysium.
Whoever has this has the power to override their whole system.
You're talking about confused with each other.
Confused with each other. Because Oblivion is the Tom Cruise runs around where he's playing against character as a human being with a soul. After Earth, which is the M. Night Shyamalan thing with Smith, Fee, and Pear.
Yes,
And Elysium. Now, this one of the three is the
most... Bald-headed, heavily tattooed Matt Damon.
Sure. But the most interesting because this is Neil Blomkamp who did District 9.
Right.
District 9 was a film that I admired more than I liked. Because I did think, at the end of the day, it was sort of like the old film, the old Mandy Patinkin vehicle, Alien Nation, with vivisection. Pretty much that's my take on that film.
And Drug Lords.
It was interesting. It was new. And so I think that this probably has this, and it also has a real hard science fiction vibe to it that you haven't been getting.
I'm curious about that one, too. Curious about that one, too.
And at three times the budget of District 9.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, in terms of fun, one of the other ones that I was optimistic about, which again could go in a variety of ways, but this Now You See Me magic movie, which is about the, don't make noises, Glenn Weldon.
Continue.
Okay. The reason why I'm sort of interested in this is a movie about a bunch of magicians. Glenn is out already. I get that. That's fine. I'm not
magicians.
Saying you have to like magicians.
Ladies and gentlemen.
For our final trick.
We are going to rob a bank.
On the count of three, you will be teleported through space and time to your bank in Paris.
One, two,
three.
Everyone in this room was a victim of hard times.
Some of you lost your homes, your cars.
And so tonight,
we're going to return some of that money back to you.
They have sort of a Robin Hood angle where they're trying to return money to people. Now, look, I'm not.
Okay. We agree that this is a pretty tortured concept.
Of course it's
already.
Of course it's a tortured concept. But the flip side of a tortured concept is I haven't already seen it. And the question I have about this is, and you can't really tell from the trailer, is whether it's going to ultimately be a movie that posits some sort of supernatural, mystical, actual magic. If it is, I will be much less interested in it. But I love a plot, like not plot like story, but plot like plotting. That's why I love Ocean's 11.
Sure.
I love these kind of
You want a caper? Yeah.
I like caper movies.
And a little bit of a puzzle, a little bit of a Rube Goldberg device.
It could theoretically turn out to be a caper movie in a way that I would like. But it kind of depends. There's all this
Who's all in it?
Okay, Jesse Eisenberg playing himself, playing Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
And Woody Harrelson, Mark Ruffalo, Morgan Freeman. So it's a good it's a good cast.
Mark Ruffalo playing a character who in the trailer is on the phone and says, I don't think I heard you right. Are you telling me that magicians robbed a bank? It's like that's a little thing right made for the trailer right there.
Yeah.
Right there.
I think it might be fun. It's directed by the guy who did the Edward Norton Incredible Hulk and the and Clash of the Titans.
Okay.
So a spotless track record. But it is written, but the writer wrote Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, okay.
So
well,
I feel good about that.
1984.
I like Bill and Ted. Be quiet.
Okay. The magic in that film is really, really, really CGI, which is one of the things that I'm kind of iffy about. Because you're right. It could be some kind of magical blah, 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 like supernatural thing. But in a film about magicians, I kind of want to see stage magic.
I agree.
You know, it seems like it's cheap. But
we'll get thee to see Ricky Jay this week.
We'll have to see how it turns out. How do we feel about The Great Gatsby?
New York, 1922. The tempo of the city had changed sharply. The buildings were higher. The parties were bigger. The morals were looser and the liquor was cheaper. The restlessness approached hysteria.
Shall we?
Who is this Gatsby?
Do you know him?
War hero. Mr. Gatsby doesn't exist.
Gatsby? What Gatsby?
Baz Luhrmann, directing.
It looks shiny.
DiCaprio.
Leo DiCaprio. It looks lavish, doesn't it?
Yeah,
speaking of people who know how to decorate a set.
Yeah, spare, ascetic, understated. That's. I mean, why isn't it a musical? It should just go ahead and be a musical.
And the stills make it, look like a musical. Really, you think, does. Like, they're all breaking into song.
Get out of the way. The car is coming.
Green light at Ash Heaps.
You know, one of the things that concerned me about it when I looked at the trailer is that the green light is literally in the trailer. And I was like, And it's not, I mean, the green light can be in the movie. That's okay. But I always worry about metaphors being translated into literal. That's one of the tough things about filming a great novel like this, right, is that things that have been suggested and are somewhat lyrical in a book can wind up looking very silly when you translate them literally onto a screen.
Right. Yeah, I think there are always great risks with something like this. You know, if somebody approaches a book like Gatsby with too much reverence, then you get something that just sort of lies there on the screen.
Yeah. But I will say that, you know, Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, which also had DiCaprio in it, and Claire Danes, his Romeo and Juliet I did think was lovely in places. It wasn't perfect. It had some strange beats in it. But I did think it was a lovely movie. Very creative and very, very pretty.
It had a lot of life, and it absolutely sort of got the essence of that story, sort of heedless passion of those two young lovers.
So, I certainly don't count it out. A Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby is one of those things where I'll be very interested to hear what other people think and then very interested to see it for myself and make a decision from that. So.
We're getting some zombies and vampires this summer because that's the law.
Excellent.
Zombies is World War Z, a book by Max Brooks, the son, by the way, of Mel Brooks.
It was written like 17 books about zombies.
Yeah, And, you know, that book was on the cusp of the whole zombie thing back in the day. And it kind of did something that a lot of books that have aped its style, have bit its style, as it were, have recapitulated. I don't think it's a particularly great book. And I am waiting for Colson Whitehead's Zone 1 to be made into a film because that was a great freaking book.
Well, there are a lot of complaints about the fact that the movie is obviously very, 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 very different from the book and departs massively from the book.
Yeah.
I didn't read the book, but you can, just from the descriptions that I've seen, it's almost a completely different story. It's almost a sort of based on the general ideas of, but the Brad Pitt story is sort of a whole cloth invention, as I understand
because
it.
Because theoretically, the book was sort of an oral history of the zombie war from many, many, many different perspectives.
Right.
This is not that.
Right.
And I'm kind of zombied out.
Yeah.
I don't care how good they look.
Yeah. I looked at descriptions of that movie, and I just got this weird vibe of troubled.
Yeah.
I got $175 million budget, PG-13, Brad Pitt. Zombies.
Mm. Lady from The Killing.
Oof.
And I can't remember, I may have this completely wrong, but I have a feeling that the release date may have gotten bumped once or twice.
I do not remember that.
And the vampires are in a film called Byzantium, not Elysium, another Eum.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's also going to confuse the same people who can't keep the rest ones.
So Byzantium is directed by Neil Jordan, who, you know, of The Crying Game and many other films. This one, to me, has a definite Hannah vibe and Let the Right One In. The reason it has a Hannah vibe is it stars the girl who played Hannah.
Yeah.
So, and it seems like it could be something more than just another vampire film, I'm going to withhold judgment, but it's something I'm curious about.
Although, God knows, Neil Jordan's last vampire movie, such a big hit.
Oh, which one was that?
Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, right.
Are you, Stephen, are you excited about, let's say, for example, The Hangover Part 3?
I am not. But, I mean, in part just because The Hangover 2, not hugely highly regarded.
Right.
But I mean, one thing I will say for Hangover 3, and one thing that I thought while looking around the schedule was I thought there's a really good chance that The Hangover 3, first of all, Hangover 2, as poorly reviewed as it was a massive, massive, massive
hit.
Yes,
it was.
And I think if you look, you know, again, talking about the heat versus so much of what else is out there, that there's a really good chance that that's going to be a sort of shockingly huge hit, in part as counter-programming. Mm. Like, this is a movie right. that is going to be gigantically silly and energetic in amongst all the apocalypse.
Well, and the one that lives at the intersection of that, of course, the intersection of those two trends for the summer is This Is the End, which is the James Franco throws a party at the apocalypse story.
Which is coming out opposite Man of Steel.
Right.
On the same weekend.
Yeah, that's right.
But kind of like opposite The Wolverine is Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine. You drop a Woody Allen film in the middle of the summer, just to kind of say.
Yeah, which well, I think very little is known about that Woody Allen film so far.
It's Alec Baldwin. It's. I mean, I was thinking about this. I mean, everybody has, or you hope, everybody has an art house theater within, say, 100 miles of them. Mm-hmm. They've got to put something on those screens.
Right.
Sure.
They're not going to hold over the artist.
Right.
Whatever, you know? So you're going to have, you know, one that I'm, you know, and I'm guessing a lot of people in this room are excited about. You have Before Midnight.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yep.
Coming out May 24th, Richard Linklater, Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy. It is the, and I know I'm not the first person to make this comparison, but that series has turned into the 7-Up of wistful, you know, of wistful romantic wistful movies.
And how did you two meet?
We met about 18 years ago. We kind of, sort of, fell in love. And a decade later, we ran into each other.
No. You wrote a book, and I read about it and went to look for it.
It's pretty romantic.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Of course.
Again, you know, it's now they're coming out every 9 years
of,
you know, this couple sort of working through their,
lives. They've been so patient with that series. And when you leave so much room, you know, not only do you allow the demand to build up again so that people are really excited about it again, but you do allow so much. And I would caution people about the trailer. If you watch the trailer, if you haven't already seen it, it does sort of give away a lot of information about sort of where we are with these two characters, which otherwise would be a surprise. It does essentially tell you where they are in life, where they are with regard to each other. So that part does get given away in the trailer. But when I watched the trailer, I thought, you really can see in the faces of the actors and their chemistry with each other, that they've known each other a long time, that the characters are really kind of settled in their bones. Mm-hmm. And even in the trailer, I thought, I just am looking forward to hanging out with these characters again. I find them really engaging people. I like the way they talk to each other. And, you know, Before Sunset sort of has a reputation of being the rare sequel that for many people was more satisfying than the original. I think people felt like in some ways the story was more, had more depth or whatever. To me, the original, as much as, I mean, I love them both.
Before Sunrise.
I love them both. But the original Before Sunrise, for me, was such a revelation to me as a movie. I really do believe, and I remember hearing Linklater quoted at the time, saying, if you can't make a movie that's just a man and a woman talking to each other, then you can't make movies.
Oh.
And I think it really is based around that premise that you ought to be able to just rely on the quality of conversation. And of course, being a talker myself and a conversation-driven person and a person who loves to sit around for 3 hours and yap with people I like, it spoke to my soul in a certain way. And I'm just, I adore that movie. I'm so excited to see this one.
Yep.
And even though it's one of those things that I try to tamp down my expectations because I feel like
everything I've heard about it says
you needn't.
Disappointed.
I know. I don't know.
Yeah, but then in 9 years' time, we get Dusk. And then after that, we get Vespers.
Yeah, they're just about out of times of day. Right. But that's the only fear I have.
How much later than midnight do you get?
There's Compline.
Okay.
Well, but that's another thing that there isn't a ton of among the movies that you're choosing from is date movies.
Yeah.
Actually, there's one coming up
But that's a good point.
That is
a
good
point.
One that shouldn't necessarily appeal to me, but it kind of does. It's a film called The Way, Way Back.
Yes.
Duncan, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think you are?
A 6.
I think you're a 3. Since I've been dating your mom, I don't see you putting yourself out there, bud. You can try to get that score up at my beach house this summer.
This in all his awkward glory.
This is my son, Duncan.
I was going to name my youngest Duncan, but we went with Peter. Finally, fixed his lazy eye. Now it's even worse.
Boop, boop. Mom.
Just stare at the bridge of his nose. That's what I do.
You're the worst parent.
The reason it kind of jumps out at me is it has a very Adventureland vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, the two guys who adapted The Descendants.
Yes.
And
Jim Rash is on Community, and
sure.
Nat Faxon was on Ben and Kate. So
right.
They're also both good TV guys.
It really reads as this is the kind of thing that film festivals would eat up. This is, you know,
it is something that film festivals
really
have eaten up. Huge Sundance.
Yep.
I could figure that.
Yeah. Steve Carell, Toni Collette, Sam
sure.
Rockwell, Maya Rudolph, Allison Janney.
Yep. We're talking about how portentous and depressing a lot of these films seem. I will give you one that is actually a film about the end of the world that looks very, very funny.
Oh, yes.
Or has the potential to be very, very funny. There's no trailer yet, which is a warning sign. That's
mm-hmm.
a red flag.
Mm.
It's The World's End.
Now on my list.
Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and Martin Freeman as a group of friends.
In an Edgar Wright movie,
where they're a group of friends who went on a pub crawl 20 years ago, and they're trying to recreate it at a pub, and as that happens, the world ends. Now, there's no way this is not going to be funny. There's no way this is not going to be at least smart, so I'm really looking forward to
it. Yeah, now, there may not be a trailer for that. As I recall, that's sort of an end-of-the-summer movie, so they may just still be putting that
together. I think something might come out this week.
And Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost have all done things that we have
Shaun
liked.
Shaun of the Dead.
Hot Fuzz.
Spaced.
Run, Fat Boy, Run.
And Edgar Wright directed Scott Pilgrim.
Sure.
Which I still consider an underrated movie that everyone should see.
Lots of great DNA.
Yeah. Well, and the two actors were in Paul, which many of us liked and felt was underrated and underappreciated, directed by Greg Mottola. And I would still recommend that one to people, too.
Yes,
speaking of Adventureland.
And Stephen, if you need an antidote to all of this depressing, world-ending kind of thing, Jess Gittner hit me one time with El Motivar.
Para enfrentarme a esas fieras, necesito pasarme de la raya. Cuando te pones en plena heroína, José R., me das miedo. ¿Quieres?
Okay, so just to put some visuals to that, that's three Spanish male flight attendants dancing in the aisle to the Pointer Sisters. I'm so excited. This seems like a return for El Motivar to the early kinds of films he did back in the Women on the Verge, Nervous
mm-hmm.
Breakdown kind of days. Open, huge, big, very colorful farces. I think this is going to be an antidote to a lot of what's going on
out
there.
Well, one other antidote that you're going to get is a bunch of animated movies,
sure.
a bunch of sort of kids' movies. I mean, Trey mentioned Epic. You've got Monsters University,
mm-hmm.
a prequel.
It's a
now,
prequel.
I love Monsters, Inc. I don't know that prequel was mm-hmm. necessarily, like I need to know how these characters got here. Not that
it... Yeah, it's just an excuse to make it, though. I mean, it's just an excuse to make Monsters University. You know what I mean? I don't think they're making the prequel on the theory that you need the story explained.
Like it's Star Wars Episode 1.
Right, exactly.
You need to know the origin of these
exactly.
characters.
Exactly.
You got Smurfs 2. Despicable Me 2 was mentioned. I have to give up my gigantic, hopeless bias.
You're in the tank.
I'm in the tank completely for Turbo.
Stay focused. That's all any driver can do. There comes a time in every race when a driver is forced to make that one key split-second decision. Take a chance. And risk it all, or play it safe and suffer defeat. Gentlemen, start your engines.
Yeah. Which is about a snail played by Ryan Reynolds,
uh-huh.
who...
Speaking of shirtlessness, but not in this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in this movie, he plays a snail. I don't know if there's shirtlessness beyond that. It is a snail who lives out his dream of racing in the Indy 500.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I am in the tank for this movie is that one of the screenwriters is one of my dearest friends, Robert Siegel. not the fake Robert Siegel we employ here at NPR. I did once stage a summit where Robert Siegel met Robert Siegel.
Right.
Rob was editor of The Onion from 1996 to 2003 and has gone on to, he wrote and directed Big Fan with Patton Oswalt and wrote the movie The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke. Now, naturally, that would lead one to write an animated snail movie. But I'm completely in the tank, but very excited.
And you've also fulfilled the, you know how the guy in Lost, there's a guy in Lost who has to enter a bunch of numbers into a computer or else something terrible happens. Steven has to mention The Onion on every podcast.
True.
Or it's basically the same thing. Something terrible happens, planes fall out of the sky, and so forth.
Speaking of movies that Steven is almost certainly going to want to see, on May 3rd, there is a movie coming out called Greetings from Tim Buckley. Which is at least as much about Jeff Buckley, of course, as it is about Tim Buckley. Yeah. It stars the charmingly named Penn Badgley, who would have the cutest name in the credits, except for the fact that Imogen Poots is in the movie.
Imogen Poots, I did see that.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm trying to reach Jeff Buckley. We're putting together a concert celebrating your father's music.
This is Jeff. This is Tim's son.
That is spooky. You look just like him.
I didn't actually know Tim had a son.
Neither did he.
My wife, she hates my music.
No.
She just hates my music.
Tim?
Emma.
Mary had the baby. You have a son, Tim.
Tim Buckley was a singer. And his son, Jeff Buckley, is essentially one of Steven's very favorite musicians ever, who died very young.
Both of them did.
Both of them did. And this movie, it appears, is from the part of Jeff Buckley's life shortly before he died.
No, actually, it's earlier than that.
Oh, is it?
It's basically, apparently they build it largely around the very beginning of Jeff Buckley's career as a singer.
Okay.
So it's him performing at this tribute concert. There are bootlegs of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Him performing at this tribute concert for his father. Jeff Buckley had only met his father once when he was about seven and had a very difficult and tortured relationship. He didn't have a relationship with his father, but a relationship with the name,
idea of
the fact that he was physically incredibly similar, that he was vocally very similar.
Mm-hmm.
The movie...
From what I understand, it's kind of a... It's in the business of making a portrait of why Tim Buckley wasn't a great father and then sort of showing some of that reflected in Jeff Buckley's feelings. Yeah.
And some of it is drawn from a very good book called Dream Brother by David Brown, the music writer. The book is very good, and I don't know that you can capture these very distinct performers. I mean, it looked very imitative. I mean, it has to be imitative.
Yeah.
The one thing I was kind of interested in about it that I thought might capture your attention and might indicate that they've paid some actual attention to making a good movie, or at least to who Jeff Buckley was the little moment where he's kind of noodling around with the guitar, doing a little bit of the what he picked up from on the Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan that he does.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's very much that kind of singing that he got, that he had that taste for, sort of.
That he worked into.
And there's
a part
in the trailer where he's sort of noodling around with the guitar, doing a little bit of that stuff. And I thought, okay, well, they paid attention to who this guy is beyond just saying hallelujah. You know what I mean?
Right. There is definitely, I'm sure there is an extraordinary amount of love toward the amazing, if you haven't heard it, amazing music of both of these singers.
Yeah.
The trailer felt very, and a part of it is it's a trailer, but you're getting the sort of a lot of stating of intentions in ways that didn't feel natural.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be curious to see how that plays out in the real movie, because I kind of feel like you have to do that in the trailer just because Jeff Buckley or no Jeff Buckley, it's kind of a marginal subject.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the process of looking at films that are coming out this summer was revelatory for me, because there were some movies that I had never heard of. Mm-hmm. I mean, and some of them were nice surprises, like The To-Do List, the Aubrey Plaza sex comedy.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like it could be a lot of fun.
It does.
But a film called that I really should have known was coming down the pike, Planes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
What?
Yes.
They're making planes?
Yes.
From the makers of Cars?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're making...
Sort of.
What?
I'm not sure if it's a... It's not a Pixar movie, I don't think.
Not?
I think it's a Disney movie.
The deal with Planes, first of all, if there's one thing people thought after seeing Cars 2, it was, I want more.
More of that.
But it was supposed to be a... It's got somewhat similar origins in terms of how it wound up happening to Toy Story 3. 3, I believe, was supposed to, maybe it was Toy Story 2, was supposed to be a direct-to-video sequel that they suddenly realized was good enough to release in theaters. Mm-hmm. So it was designed, I think, as a direct-to-video movie that they ultimately decided we could make a go of this in theaters.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, they also put out Cars. Cars 2 is not that bad. But
you know, we didn't love Cars 2.
We didn't love Cars 2.
There was not a
gigantic cultural thirst for Cars 2.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, to take a hard tonal shift from Planes, and also to reinforce Steven's sense that some of the stuff that's out this summer is going to be fairly dark. One of the ones that I'm actually very optimistic about is a movie that is inherently extremely sad called Fruitvale Station, which is about the shooting of a guy by the Oakland police.
Oh, yeah.
And he's played by Michael B. Jordan, who was Wallace on The Wire and then was also on Friday Night Lights, is incredibly charming, who I met once at the TCA Awards and was just one of the most charismatic, enchanting humans I've ever run into in person. And he is an extremely fine young actor, I feel. And he is playing this guy in this movie about, essentially, they retrace the last day of this guy's life when he wound up being shot by the police. It's an extremely sad story, but the reviews have been very positive, and the reviews especially of his performance have been very positive. It's a first-time writer-director, and so although I think that movie's going to be extremely difficult to watch, I'm very bullish on it as a creative project, mm-hmm. just because I have a ton of regard for a lot of people who are involved. And I should mention, I've been heard about this by now many, 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 many times. Mm. But if you are looking for something, it's a little bit lighter. Much Ado About Nothing is coming out.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
It's coming out this summer.
To return to the topic of date movies and things we're in the tank for, Much Ado is out in June. It's a black and white movie from Joss Whedon. Mm-hmm. It stars Nathan Fillion and a whole bunch of that guys.
Well, and Joss Whedon, that guy.
Yeah, they're
and
Joss Whedon
and that girl.
Yes,
yeah, and that
exactly.
girl.
Also black and white, out a little bit earlier in May, from Noah Baumbach, a movie called Frances Ha.
I have seen that.
Which mm-hmm. Linda saw at Toronto.
In Toronto.
I did not. So tell us a little bit more about that, will you?
Frances Ha is one of those movies. It literally opens as a black and white movie with one girl tap dancing and another girl playing the ukulele.
Right.
So I had this moment where I was like, no. But the young woman is played by Greta Gerwig. And as Trey was saying, the writer-director is Noah Baumbach. I believe that he co-wrote it with Greta Gerwig, if I'm remembering correctly.
I think that's right.
Essentially, it starts off like it's just going to be a quirky, crazy girl in the city running around tap dancing and with her friend playing the ukulele.
You're so out.
But it actually matures into a very interesting story about sort of flawed people trying to figure out how to be themselves in very difficult circumstances, where she's a little adrift, and they do a good job of making her both, you understand why people really like her and why she has dear friends. And you also understand how people would get really impatient with her because of how she behaves. So I think they do a good job of, there's no vanity in the creating of that character. It's not like, look at her and look how great and charming she is. It's not the things I don't like about what they sometimes do with like Zooey Deschanel.
Right.
The sort of like, look how charmingly quirky she is. There's charm to the quirk, but there's also a little bit of vinegar to mm-hmm. the way they present this character. I liked that about her. So I like that movie. I didn't fall in love with it, but I liked it, and I think people who like that director and actress will get what they're looking for from this movie.
Yeah. Your mention of people with flaws made me think of people with no discernible flaws, and that reminded me that this is sort of shaping up to...
This is a tortured intro here.
To try to be... I know, shut up. This is shaping up to be kind of the year of Alexander Skarsgård.
He's on True Blood, right?
Yeah, the guy for the big, tall, blonde guy from True Blood.
Gotcha.
He's in Disconnect, which is out now in at least some markets, and at the end of May, he's got another thriller out called The East with Ellen Page. It is co-directed by Britt Marling, who is also an actor in it, and she co-directs with a person called Zal Batmanglij, I think is how you pronounce it, but I can't be sure.
Sure, personal close friend of mine.
He's a Persian, Persian-American, Franco-Persian director who's kind of an indie scene one to watch. He did a movie called Sound of My Voice, which was a kind of low-budget cult/mystery/thriller movie that got a lot of attention at a couple of festivals.
Yeah.
How do we feel about The Lone Ranger?
I was just going to say, the last on my list, we've done a remarkable job of covering everything I had on my list, both the ones I wanted to talk about.
And Grown Ups, too, directed by Dennis Dugan.
Right, of course. You know, the thing about The Lone Ranger, I said this on Twitter the other day, I don't know if I'm going to be more disheartened if we have a big conversation, not us, but culturally, about Johnny Depp playing Tonto, or if we don't have it. Right. I mean, I'm sort of either one of those things, just I find a terribly grim prospect, and the presentation of Tonto, like if you look at the trailer, they're trying, you know, they're not doing the old Lone Ranger insulting, thing that he, but he still has this, there's this tone of sort of wise,
they're doing their best to cover their backsides with this.
Sure,
you know, he's been created an actual Comanche now.
But it's also like it's also like the last thing that hasn't been adapted.
Right.
sort of what I felt like.
It's somewhat true. There is a whole thing when it, you know, that when he puts the mask on and you just feel like, I don't know if I need it. It's Gore Verbinski who did the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
But also did what was the last thing Johnny
Rango.
Depp was in?
Rango. Also did Rango.
Yeah, it's the same team that did Rango.
It's not that it's going to be bad. I'm just, I don't know.
It's one of those movies. And again, I've only seen the trailer. I mean, I've only seen little bits and pieces. But how did they spend $215 million on a Lone Ranger movie? No. Blowing up entire planets, I don't understand how
was
that much money gets spent.
No, this wasn't the one where they were making their own trains. What movie was that?
I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't know.
No, I don't. It was the one where they were making their own
just
trains.
Just Werner Herzog pulling trains over
them. I think they made their own trains. I think there's, and I could be wrong, I'll check that fact and we'll remove it as if I never said it, if it isn't true. But I think that's the one where they made their own trains. Well, and that's why it's so expensive, is that rather than, there were no replica trains that made Gore Verbinski happy. Yeah. So he went out and they built trains.
Yeah, I just have a feeling like we're going to read an article about why this movie turned out the way it did.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a $250 million movie, and they managed to scale it back and pinch their pennies to get it
down to 215.
Yeah, boy. Wow. I don't know. And I don't.
Well, I guarantee you one way or the other, there will be an All Things Considered feature about this movie, because our Robert Siegel is the biggest fan of The Lone Ranger
in the world.
Well,
really? Fascinating.
Okay. I had no idea. Because I was going to say no one was clamoring.
Yeah. Perhaps Robert Siegel was clamoring. All right. Well, I would hope that all of you would come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or to the blog at npr.org/PCHH and talk to us about what summer movies you are interested in and thinking about, and let us know what you are clamoring for, if in fact you are clamoring. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, last week was kind of a mopey and reflective week, you know, for all news-related reasons.
Yes.
And that led me in two diametrically opposite directions. Mm-hmm. One is to the American Psycho parody, in which you have Huey Lewis as Patrick Bateman doing Hip to Be Square, and it also involves Weird Al Yankovic, we'll just leave it at that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So then on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we've been working up a story on Iron and Wine, a man/band whose music I really love. And there's a piece that they've been working on for All Things Considered, and I was talking to them about, you know, what to ask him, and that sent me down the rabbit hole of watching on YouTube all the different live performances I could find of two of my favorite songs of all time. One is called Naked As We Came, and one is called The Trapeze Swinger. The Trapeze Swinger in particular, if you haven't heard it, it's a somewhat lesser-known Iron and Wine song. It is 8 verses, no chorus, 9 minutes long, and it is absolutely stunning. So we'll hear a little piece of it, but of course it is part of a song that's 9 minutes long and goes in a whole bunch of lyrical directions. But let's hear a little bit of The Trapeze Swinger.
Please remember me happily by the rosebush laughing with bruises on my chin. Caught us in the kitchen with maps, a mountain range, a piggy bank.
favorite thing about this song, besides the fact that it is this song and it is so incredible, it was written to play over the closing credits of the Topher Grace movie In Good Company.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And
wow.
It is a masterpiece. Anyway, if you haven't heard it, The Trapeze Swinger by Iron and Wine, and also if you don't know it, the song Naked As We Came is just a complete, just wrecks me every time. And so yeah, those two diametrically opposite responses to sad things.
Wonderful. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
A couple things. You know, Linda, when people come to me and they say, Glenn, what is the crowning achievement of human civilization? I am torn.
Yeah.
So many different ways to go. Is
right.
Is it movable type? Someone
uh-huh.
could make that case.
Uh-huh.
Is it penicillin?
Yeah.
Is it fire? Certainly not a human invention, but something we have tamed.
Sure.
Right. Discovered how to master.
Sure. Or let's back up. Language. Maybe it's language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just worried about where this is going.
My day job sent me to London last week, where I encountered the pinnacle of human endeavor, and that is the heated towel rack. Oh my God. Why do we not have them here? We need to have them here now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you know, I don't go in for sybaritic pleasures.
I hate to break this to you. I hate to break this to you, but they are available to every air traveler in the SkyMall catalog.
Really? See, I was prepared to, because if we need to become subjects of the British Crown just to get them over here, I am prepared to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Independence, let's get them.
We could fight another war.
Right, exactly. I mean, my teeth and I have had a good long run, you know? If that's what it takes, we need to become subjects of the British Crown. But it was...
Do they have heated towel racks in Canada?
that's a very good question.
I am envisioning the way that Stephen is filing this away for the next time that he takes uh-huh. crap about the Zaxxon machine.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God, it's so good.
Oh, yeah.
But I do have something. So while I was over there, I sent out a Twitter alert thing to see if any pop culture happy hour
I
fans...
I know. You offered to just meet people, strangers, at random.
So like you.
It was extremely un-me. But I met four great pop culture happy hour listeners and one bemused husband who was kind of dragging me. We had beer, we had food, and they fit the profile of the pop culture happy hour listener. You'll be glad to know it's an international, funny, smart, and not a little sexy. So
librarians
with great teeth, by the way. No, they went out their way to tell me they were not librarians, but two of them worked in publishing. So,
yeah.
So for Alex, Charlotte, Jonathan, Angela, and Neil, thank you for a very nice evening. You know, and when I told you about that, Linda, you emailed me back saying, "Strangers are awesome," which is just I can't subscribe to that.
We're bringing you around on people. I'm
no,
glad to hear it.
No.
Yeah, you're coming around.
On the way over to London, I read Sam Lipsight's collection of short stories, The Fun Parts. And then on the way back, I read 10th of December, the George Saunders collection, which I'd read all those stories before. But
mm-hmm.
the first story in it, Victory Lap, I want to specifically recommend because I saw him read that story, and I would encourage people to just read the story for yourself because I hope sometime we get to talk about the author reading and how fraught it is.
Yes,
because he did a good job, but I want my authors to be authors, not performers.
Yeah, we have talked about this. Yeah,
okay.
We talked about this once with regard to the reading that you and I went to with Emma
right.
Donoghue and
yeah.
And Chris.
Yeah, that's the one. He read the story very well, but he read it, you know, he's a middle-aged skinny dude doing a 14-year-old girl's voice.
Yeah.
And it's distracting. You don't
yeah.
hear it. You don't experience it. You have to read the story yourself.
Yeah.
And it's a great story. Victory Lap by George Saunders.
Wonderful. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, well, like Stephen, was a little moody. I have been a little moody recently. So I returned...
It's not like I don't know what you're going to say.
I returned today to a recording and a live performance, really, of something that I may have mentioned on here before. But in any case, I went back to it. A woman named Dorothy Loudon, who was the original Miss Hannigan in Annie on Broadway, she also starred in a show called Ballroom, which was the follow-up to basically the whole creative team behind A Chorus Line. It was their big follow-up
mm-hmm.
was called Ballroom. It went nowhere. It was a gigantic flop. Or at least a flop. But Dorothy Loudon had an 11 o'clock number in that show called 50%.
If anyone had told me a year and a half ago that Maury would be gone, I wouldn't have believed it. If anyone had told me I'd open up a store, make a go of it once more, I wouldn't have believed it.
It is just a beautiful piece of songwriting. And her performance, specifically a benefit performance at Carnegie Hall on a DVD and CD called My Favorite Broadway, The Leading Ladies, Dorothy Loudon at the end of her career singing this song in the character of a woman who's sort of in the latter stages of her life, who's discovered love for a man who probably isn't ready to commit to her, and she's willing to take what she can get.
Mm-hmm.
It's melancholy, and Dorothy Loudon is sort of doing what she can with mm-hmm. the diminished resources of a performer who has been at it for a long mm-hmm. time, has been largely retired. It's just wonderful, and I'll link out to it from the blog. Two other quick theater-related things, and then a final actual Making Me Happy this week. Downton Abbey Season 4, Episode 1, The Musical.
Americans have always been resentful that the English get to see Downton Abbey first.
Oh,
a stage parody staged at the nightclub 54 Below
lovely.
Recently. Available on YouTube for your pleasure.
Lovely, lovely.
And the recent emergence on Twitter of @AngrySondheim.
Oh, gosh.
Someone is a fake Twitter account in the character of a pissed off Stephen Sondheim.
Oh, nice.
Complaining about things like the internal rhyming of Oz and is or ever was in Wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And about how it makes his eyes bleed.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that is actually really, truly making me happy to the point of I cried a little bit when I watched it. There's a YouTube video going around or a Vimeo video going around of a young man proposing to his partner of 5 years using flashcards and many, many family members to hold them up. Even like little nephews and nieces and dogs. They're all holding these cards. And it's wordless. No one says a word. Mm-hmm. It's all written out on these flashcards. And Stephen Thompson, the music that's playing behind this lovely 6 or 9 minute proposal, it goes on. Bon Iver.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how nice.
It's very, very sweet.
Wonderful. Well, Trey let me down. I was sure that he was going to be the one to mention the thing that I'm now going to mention that I wasn't going to mention because I was so sure that Trey would get to it before me. During the incredibly bleak week that we just had, the thing that interrupted this week sort of in the middle and flew across the internet to the great joy of everyone involved, including me, was the letter from the Delta Gamma girl who wanted everyone to know that they should stop being lame and boring. And it is this sort of epic letter in which she is a horrible person. She is a horrible person and yet hilariously profane. And I mean, people have been comparing it to like a Mamet monologue. It is, I don't even know how to explain it. It's incredibly, horribly not safe for work. It will break every language filter you've ever had. It contains a couple of really offensive terms that no one should use. And yet you can't look away from it. It's so awful. And then today, a video emerged of Michael Shannon reciting this letter. And it is, you have to see it. You just have to see it. There's nothing else I can say. I had been clamoring for someone to read it. I was clamoring. Someone to do a dramatic reading. And I sort of feel like now there have been a couple of them, but this is the one that to me was the most effective.
Yeah.
And I just feel the door is now closed.
You know, he plays General Zod in Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. And there's a video going around of him doing an interview where he describes how he got into the part of General Zod. And I've never seen Boardwalk Empire. I don't really know the guy.
Yeah.
I was not hopeful because he comes across in that interview as just inert is the word. Just he's not giving anything. And
he'll be wonderful.
I now realize that he was saving it up for that because that was so good.
Yeah, he was also really good in Premium Rush, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt bike movie, which is very, very silly, but mm-hmm. he is kind of over-the-top villainous in it and is great. It'll be great. Yeah, so that's A.
This thing, first of all, I hear you about mm-hmm. the greatness of this particular reading.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to reserve judgment about the door being closed, though, because in the interest of gender accuracy, I'm holding out for the Judi Dench version.
Well, sure, of course. So that's A. And then B is quickly the follow-up to the thing that was making me happy last week, which is that I was at the International Championships of Collegiate Acapella on Saturday
How did
night.
We get, like, this far into the show.
I know.
56 minutes. Awesome.
It was wonderful. It was fascinating. The groups were all great. I fell in love with the British. I fell in love with the group that was representing the international region. Because, of course, in an international competition, you have 7 U.S. regions and 1 international region. So my favorites, they were a group called Sons of Pitches, and they are from the University of Birmingham in the U.K. Shut up.
Here comes treble.
You can all bite me. You couldn't do it. And so that was wonderful. And then the last thing I would mention is if you are looking still for another really good TV show, I would recommend Rectify, which is starting tonight as we tape this Monday night on Sundance again. If you liked Top of the Lake, if that's your speed, this is clearly kind of what they're doing, is these really moody. They managed to be moody, but not to feel slow to me. I really, really liked it, and I would recommend that you give it a try if you're interested in that sort of thing. I'm sure they'll rerun it a million times as they did with Top of the Lake.
Shall we talk a bit about the plot?
In short, it is about a guy who gets out of jail after a very long time, after being released because of DNA evidence, newly discovered DNA evidence. He's served a very long time and he gets out, which is something that is happening in the world to a certain number of people. And so a lot of it is about him trying to readjust to life. And, you know, of course, he doesn't know how to use a cell phone and things like that. So, and he doesn't have work, and he's trying to readjust to all his relationships and stuff like that. So it's very good. I have not seen all of it. I have only seen the first couple of hours, but very good. I liked it a lot. Rectify on Sundance. And that's what's making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here in our new digs.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.